Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Hi, it's Mike Collins. WFAE is in the midst of our fall membership campaign. We're bringing you this podcast without fundraising breaks. But first, I do have a quick pitch before we get to the show. Everything we do at WFAE is paid for by our listeners. Consider supporting Charlotte Talks right now for $20 a month, and we'll send you a Public Radio Nerd t-shirt. Give online at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. And thank you for your support. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Bill Kristol has been a figure in politics and conservative thought for decades. He was a staff member in both the Reagan and the George H.W. Bush administrations, and of course, he was founder of the Weekly Standard. His sometimes controversial thoughts on politics are still sought out. He is a frequent analyst and commentator on several networks, including CNN and MSNBC. Today, he also serves as a visiting professor at Davidson College, where he is the Vann Professor of Ethics and Society. In fact, he'll be speaking there tonight with Mike Allen from Axios about the upcoming presidential election. An outspoken critic of President Trump, his presentation is called 2020. It only gets worse from here. Bill Kristol gives us a preview this hour, and he joins us via Skype. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Mike. Good to be with you.
Welcome. I see you on TV all the time. I have for years, of course, as everybody else has, but I had no idea that you were teaching at Davidson College. How long has that been going on?
I did a couple of talks in the spring, but actually I'm teaching a seminar this fall, and it's every Monday, and it's been great to get back in the classroom and talk with intelligent young men and women. It cheers you up, you know, after being in D.C. and, you know, submerged in Trump controversy for six days a week. It's nice to have at least, you know, 3 hours in a classroom with the phone off and the radio off, no offense to radio, and the TV off, and we discussed the Declaration of Independence and some letters of Jefferson's last week and some Frederick Douglass speeches next week. And it's, you know, the students are really terrific. So it's been a lot of fun.
Do you find that the students at Davidson mesh with your school of thought?
I mean, it's hard to tell. I've got a small seminar, and I don't ask them their own political views. I try not to. I mean, they may know mine, but I don't, you know, proselytize in the classroom. I would say this, that so far, Lee, I mean, I'm worried about colleges and universities in the sense that I think there have been attempts to constrict, you know, freedom of speech and sort of stifle some unpopular thoughts. But I've seen none of that at Davidson. And actually, the president of Davidson, Carol Quillen, has been quite eloquent. She's spoken on this and written on this, on the importance of freedom of speech and freedom of thought. So that feels like that's the atmosphere I've enjoyed so far at Davidson. I'll teach again this afternoon. And then I have this event, as you mentioned, tonight with Mike Allen. That'll be a bigger event, a couple of hundred people there. We'll take questions. And Mike is such a good journalist and so on top of everything that I'm curious to hear his take on politics, on media, social media, all these kinds of topics.
So your seminar, your class is called or titled Dilemmas of Ethics and Public Service. And it seems today that ethics may be in short supply in some areas. What are the dilemmas?
Well, it's funny. So today, for example, we're discussing an essay by Elliot Cohen, who served in the Bush administration as Condi Rice's sort of counselor, very distinguished foreign policy scholar, dean of the Johns Hopkins School in Washington now. And he wrote a piece warning, I would say, people against going into the Trump administration, that they might have to compromise their own standards, their own principles so much that it would end up being a sort of devil's bargain. I wrote a piece slightly the other way, actually, even though I'm pretty anti-Trump. This is about 2 years ago, defending Mattis, McMaster, people like that, being in the White House and in the administration for the good they could do for the country and, you know, urging them, frankly, to stay and to do their best. So that's the kind of dilemma, isn't it? If you're a young person, if you don't approve of the president, if you really even disapprove of him pretty heartily, but you think you can do some good by going into the EPA or the Justice Department or something like that, I mean, do you go in or not? Are there different jobs you should or shouldn't take? And that's one of many, obviously. I think the main point of the course in my mind, in a way, is to show that these are dilemmas. You know, that's the one thing I sort of I thought about the title of the course some. And I think originally we were thinking of just calling it Ethics and Public Service. And I wanted to call it Dilemmas of Ethics and Public Service because, you know, you can be a good person. You can want to do good. But it's not always easy to know what's doing good, right, in politics or in life in general. And so we're reading some essays on that topic. We discussed the founding and slavery and the question of the compromises the founders had to make or felt they had to make and what the implications of those were. On the one hand, you have the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. That becomes very important and ultimately, I think, doing away with slavery and really important in terms of world history. On the other hand, they kind of legitimated slavery in America for obviously a long time after 1776. So, you know, these are, I think getting students, getting young people to see that life is complicated in these ways and that these choices aren't always just about, well, this is, you know, this is the good thing to do and everyone else is evil. I hope I can complicate people's thinking a little bit.
Yeah. People know you from television and writing and the Weekly Standard, and I think you run a publication called The Bulwark now, if I'm not mistaken. And so they think of you exclusively as somebody with conservative bona fides, and it seems baked into your DNA because your father was a conservative, a well-known conservative as well. But early in your life, you campaigned for Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. How did that happen?
Well, he was actually a friend of my parents. My parents, my father became pretty well known as one of the first neoconservatives, but he had been a liberal. He had supported people like Hubert Humphrey and civil rights movement and was kind of a liberal anti-communist. And so that was sort of where I began. I remember I was never really on the left. I disliked the new left, and I thought it was doing damage to our institutions. I was more of a traditional liberal. In 72, when I was in college, I volunteered and did some volunteer work. I mean, those days you handed out leaflets at supermarkets and, you know, train stations and stuff. Mm-hmm. For Scoop Jackson, the liberal anti-communist Democratic senator from Washington State who was running in the primary. It was the beginning of my very successful political career. I think Scoop ran seventh in the Massachusetts primary, and I've had a pretty good losing. Moynihan was the one campaign I worked on. That was the summer of 76, the Senate campaign, where he won the primary by one percentage point, actually, and launched a very distinguished Senate career. That's one of my few winning campaigns. But no, I have an affection still, though, honestly, maybe more now within the era of Trump, for that kind of centrist Democrat and centrist Republican, people who really, you know, they cared about the country. Of course, they happened to be Democrats or Republicans back in those days, but they didn't really think about things in nearly as partisan terms as we do now. Pat Moynihan, this is almost inconceivable today. Pat Moynihan was a Democrat. He ran for office. He worked for the Democratic governor of New York way back in the 50s and early 60s, ran for office as a Democrat in New York City in 1965, then served in the Nixon administration in the Nixon White House and was ambassador to India and then ambassador to the UN and then ran as a Democrat in 76 for the Senate. But on some issues was closer, you know, to the Republican Party. I mean, I think that was a healthier there was something healthy about that and the hyper partisanship of today. And we've really seen it culminate in the last two or three years, I think, is not good for the country.
Yeah. It was only about 20 years after your work with Daniel Patrick Moynihan that you led the project for the Republican Future, in which you helped develop strategy that produced the Republican victories in the 94 election. As you look at the future of the Republican Party today, what do you see?
I mean, it's not a happy picture, and it's always been a mix. Parties are always a mixed bag. You know, we shouldn't romanticize the past. There've been elements of both parties that were sort of questionable, but I do think both parties in the past have managed to keep those elements a little bit at arm's length. They're sort of on the fringes. I do think with Trump dominating the Republican Party, we do have a demagogic and authoritarian kind of nativist spirit dominating the party. And it's one thing for him. He got himself elected president. So, you know, fair enough. But the degree to which the party has felt compelled to go along with him is really astonishing. I mean, I don't think everyone has to sound like me. They don't have to criticize him all the time. They don't have to support primary challenges to him. Couldn't they just keep their distance and sort of say, look, I'm for free trade, even though the president isn't, or I'm for American global leadership, even though the president is wavering on that. But they're so intimidated by Trump and by Trump supporters or feel somehow, I mean, I guess they're scared of losing primaries, but also that they think somehow this is the wave of the future and they need to sign on to this kind of populist nativist agenda. It's not a healthy thing, I think. And I tell this to you, I mean, we don't get into Trump at all in the classroom and all that. But, you know, if you think of politicians once admired, and this is true on the left and the right, North Carolina has both, actually, in its history, ranging from Terry Sanford to Jesse Helms. Whatever you think of them, they stood up for what they believed is right. They didn't just go along with you know, what was the prevailing sentiment of the day. And you just hate to see everyone just buckling because, you know, Trump happens to be president.
I have about a minute left, but how do you explain that? Because there have been strong political leaders. There have been strong presidents. LBJ comes to mind. He knew the Congress like the back of his hand. He knew how it works. He knew how to manipulate the levers of power. And yet he didn't get his way. They didn't buckle to him every single time on every single issue. He had to work hard to get some things done. How do you explain this capitulation?
Yeah, and LBJ had won an election by 20 percentage points, whereas Trump won by, you know, minus two or two right. and a half points. So I don't know. I mean, some of it is partisanship. Some of it is fear of primary challenges. Some of it is the tribalism, I think. You so hate the other side that you're so fearful of it that you feel like you've all got to huddle together on the side you're in. Some of it is a kind of excessive unwillingness to just say, look, maybe my public and district doesn't quite agree with this, but I think this is right, and I'm going to do that. I remember when politicians said that, you know, and the conservatives especially were proud. Edmund Burke, the great patron saint of conservatism, has a speech in 1774, I think it is, where he says a representative owes an obligation to his conscience and to the country, not simply to, you know, cater to every view, every whim, every opinion of his constituents. But that is not the... That is not the way people are behaving these days.
Bill Kristol speaks tonight at Davidson. It's a sold-out event, but it's called 2020. It only gets worse from here. Not encouraging words, but we'll find out a little bit what he's thinking along those lines when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Bill Kristol, the founder of the Weekly Standard, a leader in conservative thought for decades in this country, and now a professor, visiting professor of ethics and society at Davidson College, where he's speaking tonight to a sold-out crowd about 2020. It only gets worse from here. You have never been on the Donald Trump bandwagon. Others were with you on that bandwagon until he began to defeat some mainstream Republicans in the primaries leading up to the last election. And a lot of those other never-Trumpers, including some of the candidates he defeated, have either gone along with the Trump flow or have gone radio silent. Not you. Why are you dug in?
I mean, I just think he's not a good president, and I think it would be much better for the country if he did not have a second term. I think in a way we've dodged a lot of bullets here in the first term. The institutions have restrained him. Some of his own cabinet members have restrained him. Obviously, Jim Mattis, McMaster, people like that, a lot of them have gone. I think an emboldened and reelected Trump behaving in a more Trumpy way than even he has so far would really be dangerous for the world order, for the country's institutions, for the country's well-being. So that's, you know, that's my view. People are free to differ, obviously. But that's what I've been trying to argue, and that's why I've encouraged various people to, you know, consider running against him in the primaries and so forth.
Yeah, and you were this way before he was elected. You've never changed. So what were your objections to Donald Trump initially before he took office, and how have they changed, if they've changed, since his being in office?
You know, I mean, just on that point, which is a very good way of putting it. You know, I was open to the notion. I was against him. I thought he was not well qualified to be president and above all lacked the judgment, the temperament, the character to be president. I don't agree with him on a bunch of issues. But for me, that was really secondary to the fundamental questions of character and judgment. But I was open to the notion that he would get elected and sort of say, OK, look, I'm president. I never kind of expected this to happen. It's kind of a fluke. But, you know, I've got to really now live up to it. And I'm going to kind of, you know, be more serious than I have been and less demagogic and less nativist. And I'm not going to accuse people of being, you know, Mexican judges because their parents came from Mexico. And I'm going to not be as much of a demagogue on a whole bunch of issues and so forth. There were some indications that he might do that, but those indications were quickly overwhelmed by the fact that he enjoys being himself and he's actually been somewhat rewarded. He thinks he has, at least, for being himself. And as I say, if anything, he's getting more this way, not less. And, you know, you'd think 3 years in, you wouldn't be, you know, taking over a delicate negotiation, deciding to have it at Camp David, you know, messing it up so it doesn't actually happen, then tweeting out that it didn't happen and now probably putting back. I'm a doubter about these negotiations anyway, but a skeptic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, putting back the effort to rather important foreign policy objective that people have been working pretty hard on. So he hasn't gotten better. But for me, the fundamental problem was, and I think this is true of a lot of my friends and colleagues who were also conservatives, but against Trump, was a little less the ideology that, you know, I don't agree with him on free trade, American leadership, but more just basic lack of judgment, character, and temperament to be president.
You mentioned that you don't really talk about Trump in the seminar that you teach at Davidson College, but the Davidsonian, which was which is the school newspaper, ran two opinion pieces when your position as the Vann Professor of Ethics and Society was announced there. One was in your favor, one of you being on campus. The other was against. And in the one against you, written by Matthew Bandick, as a former editor and alumnus of the school and a former editor of the paper, wrote that, quote, as disastrous as the Trump presidency has been, Trump and his administration still have not done anything as damaging as the Iraq invasion. You supported that invasion. You said the war would last 2 weeks, that we'd be greeted as liberators. You were wrong. So is Matthew Bandick correct?
No, I would still defend the Iraq war. I mean, it was carried out badly, and I will say in my defense that I was very critical of Don Rumsfeld and the failure to have enough troops early on. I think we obviously won the intense fighting very quickly, but then did not manage the post-war situation at all well. And look, people can reasonably differ. We didn't find the weapons of mass destruction. Obviously, I was deceived on that, as so many people were. But people can differ on the wisdom of that, and I'm happy to debate it. I think it's a fair thing, and people are entitled to say that I was wrong and entitled to say that for that reason, I suppose, I shouldn't be on campus. It's a little weird, I think, given that the war was authorized by a pretty big vote in the House and in the Senate and by the elected president and, you know, was carried on for years, even by President Obama in his first 2 years. He tried to wind it down in a successful way. I mean, it's a little weird, I think, to say that someone who supported that war should be barred from a campus, but obviously he's entitled to his opinion. And it hasn't honestly come up so far, but I'm happy to discuss it. I think
have said the war in Iraq was the worst foreign policy decision in the history of the country. Has President, I don't know whether it deserves that appellation, but has the current president, done anything worse than make that decision?
It's nothing even close to that. It's not even clear to me it was a bad decision. I mean, at the end of the war in Iraq in 2008, after the surge, which I strongly supported and which succeeded, the Middle East wasn't transformed for the better, as people like me hoped. It wasn't transformed for the worse. Nothing much had changed, honestly. Saudi Arabia was Saudi Arabia. Iran was Iran. The neighborhood was the neighborhood. There were a lot of deaths, obviously, and casualties and destruction in Iraq. I would say the Syria non-intervention has been much more damaging than the Iraq intervention, as many people have died in Syria, and it really has destabilized the region and destabilized Europe with the migrant crisis. So I'm not, I don't buy all that wildly excessive rhetoric about Iraq. It was a difficult war. Afghanistan's been difficult now. The lesson I take from that is that we need to be careful, but also execute these interventions as well as we can and be full and make sure we have the resources to do it, not try to do it on the cheap as we did in a way in Iraq and in a way in Afghanistan, too. But I think the lesson of history is if you get out of these places and just leave them alone, you're really asking for trouble in the world and trouble for the U.S.
Bill Kristol is our guest, the founder of the Weekly Standard and a frequent commentator on various networks, including CNN and MSNBC. We've talked a little bit about the hyper-partisan nature of our politics today and how one side has great difficulty in talking to the other. You are on CNN. You are also on MSNBC, which some people on the right compare to they look at MSNBC like people on the left look at Fox News. Are they the liberal equivalent in your mind, since you're on the network? Are they the liberal equivalent of Fox News?
I mean, it's a little hard for me to say. I honestly don't watch any of them that much since I'm on them. The last thing I need is to, like, watch them all the rest of the time. So I probably don't have the best granular feel for what MSNBC is like 24 hours a day or what Fox is like. I would say Fox, in the old days, when I was on Fox News Sunday, which was 2002 to 2012, and on special reports on election night coverage and, you know, on a fair amount, Fox was certainly conservative leaning. Let's not, you know, there's no doubt about that. But they did try to feature, you know, reasonable liberals. Juan Williams and I became good friends because he was on Fox so much. Mara Liasson was on. There were a lot of reporters who were just offering straight analysis, really. Certainly on some of the shows. Some of the shows are much more opinion heavy, though even those shows, I think, were a little more varied sometimes in the opinions they would give. I do think in the last few years, Fox has really degenerated into a real rabble-rousing of an irresponsible kind, much, much more of that than there used to be, and also just totally one-sided. I mean, there's not even a pretense of having much in the way of discussion anymore. MSNBC is liberal, and, you know, most of the conservatives they have on are people like me who are anti-Trump, so they're not a lot of Trump defenders on. But I've got to say, the discussions I've been in, you know, have mostly been analytical, really. I mean, I don't spend much time denouncing Trump on TV. I don't hide my views, but usually I think my comparative advantage is having been in government for 7 years, having covered, been editing a magazine in Washington, been involved in politics. Maybe I have a little bit to say about, well, what's really happening here, what's happening on the Hill. So I try to be analytical, but, you know, when I'm on Andrea Mitchell or Ari Melber or Brian Williams, that's mostly what we do.
Do you think they want you there only because your point of view on Trump plays to their audience, or because they really do want the perspective of a traditional conservative? And do you think you'll be there if Trump is defeated?
I think they probably have mixed motives. That depends. Different people have different. But to be fair, you know, it's not like there's one, you know, place. I don't think there is at least one place at 30 Rock that makes these decisions. You know, I'm not paid by them. Different shows call and ask me to come on. I'm a freelancer and I just do it, you know, for no pay. And some shows want to have me on. Brian Williams wants to have an intelligent discussion, I think, of what's happened that day in Washington. Other people probably have much more, you know, kind of partisan or polemical or ideological motives, which is fine. There's no bar against having them on those kinds of shows on TV as well. I don't know if they'll be interested in me if Trump is defeated. I think the issue, if Trump is defeated, of where conservatism goes, where the Republican Party goes, is a huge issue and one that I hope to participate in the debate over, whether I'm on MSNBC or not.
In January of this year, you spoke, if I'm not mistaken, on the topic, is ethical public service still possible? And the Trump administration has certainly been plagued, whether you agree with him or not, with ethical questions, many of which the president and his cabinet members have successfully dodged. But those who oppose him see the most corrupt and unethical administration in the nation's history, while those on the right are still solidly supporting him. So how would you characterize the Trump administration when it comes to ethics?
Well, I think it's been pretty bad. And I say, you know, I'm hostile to Trump, so people can discount this. But I will just say, having been in government, having been in the White House, the ways in which we had to routinely, you know, try to be careful not to have conflicts of interest, I mean, they've just steamrolled over all that. Now, maybe I think the Trump's defenders would say this. That's kind of, those things were always, A, they weren't really obeyed that much, and B, that was just kind of fastidious silliness, filling out forms. And who cares if Ivanka and Jared are in the White House? And who cares if Trump and Trump's family still controls all these properties that have government officials stay and where foreign governments spend money and so forth? But I mean, from my point of view, people I know who wanted to go into public service, very good, decent people, the hoops that we all had to jump through. I luckily had no money at the time and had no, you know, other affiliation, so it didn't really matter for me. I just kind of showed up and put my money in a mutual fund, and that was it. But, you know, I knew people who were adjunct professors at Georgetown teaching one course in the evening for very little salary, really, as a public service, because they had been in government for a while. They came back into the Bush administration really out of public, spiritedness. And they said, can I still teach this course one evening a week at Georgetown? And they said, well, you can't get paid by Georgetown because Georgetown, you know, has certain contracts with the federal government or whatever. So this is a true story. So this friend of mine said, OK, well, then I'll just do it for free. I really enjoy teaching these kids who are going into the Foreign Service and so forth. So no, you better not do it. The impression could be that somehow because you're there and that if someone from Georgetown gets hired, it looks like there's some kind of, you know, something inappropriate. I mean, that's the degree to which people went. Maybe that was too much, incidentally. But that's the degree to which people went in the old days. And that was in the Bush administration and the Obama administration. That was bipartisan. Trump is just obviously, you know, we're in a whole different world now. And I think it's a bad world. It's a world where everything that the government does, you ask the question, well, who's benefiting? What's going on? Is there really, you know, is there corruption there?
Well, on the one hand, it's blatantly obvious. He doesn't try to hide it. He's not doing it behind the scenes. But on the other hand, I mean, if we have this, I don't want to get bogged down in the emoluments clause, but if we have such a clause and it's been followed by previous presidents, why aren't people on both sides up in arms about it and taking action on it?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, it's hard for the courts to get into some of these things. I think Congress could have done much more. The Republican Congress, obviously, in the first 2 years was uninterested in doing anything for reasons that we discussed already. The Republican Party's amazing acquiescence to Trump. Now, there's still a Republican Senate. The Democrats in the House could do more, but they're a little overwhelmed by the amount of the number of things they would have to deal with. But I do think it percolates down. I mean, I'm struck. If you look at what's happened in some of these agencies, the scandals there, the people that have been removed, you know, these people went in and they were kind of got the signal that, you know what, you don't have to really obey these tiresome ethics rules. You know, you can go ahead and do these things for lobbyists and then leave and the next Monday turn out to show up working for the same company that you were just writing regulations for. There's always been a little of that. There's always been some of that in Washington, obviously. But the degree to which it's done in a pretty shameless way today is bad for the country. I think if people lose respect for their government, they lose faith in the government. People on Trump's side think, oh, great, we can all just have fun and benefit. But that's not really healthy in the long run either.
Well, a lot of pundits, particularly on the left, bemoan the fact that in addition to the crimes that the president may or may not have committed and the institutions and traditions of the government that he's gone after, and not just government, but society, fake news, the fake news media, that the genie is out of the bottle and you can't put the genie back in. We have about 30 seconds left here in this segment, but above all else, Donald Trump has changed the presidency forever, they say. Do you agree with that?
I don't think that's necessarily true, but I think it worrisomely could be true. I think I'm going to discuss that a lot with Mike Allen tonight, who I know has thought a lot about this, both in terms of the media and our political and social institutions.
Okay, well, maybe we can come back and talk a little bit more about that and some other things about how we found ourselves in this pickle and how it got to this point. With Bill Kristol, founder of the Weekly Standard, editor-at-large of The Bulwark, and the inaugural visiting Vann Professor of Ethics and Society at Davidson College. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Bill Kristol, who is the Vann Professor of Ethics and Society at Davidson College. Of course, you know him as the founder of the Weekly Standard. He now is the editor-at-large of The Bulwark. He appears frequently on television as a commentator on CNN's MSNBC, among others. And he's speaking tonight at the sold-out event at Davidson called 2020. It only gets worse from here. So let's explore that a little bit. There were a lot of us who were surprised at some of the things that the president has been doing or not doing, that other presidents have done or not done, because we thought that some of the things that presidents were constrained by were codified. It turns out they were just doing it because they felt it was the right thing to do. So will there be, do you think, when this presidency ends, whether it's in 2021 or it's 4 years after that, will there be a backlash? Will some of these things be made mandatory?
You know, I don't know, Mike. It's a good question. That title for the talk's a little bit. That's a really conversation with Mike Allen. I'm going to blame the title on him. He's maybe a little more pessimistic than I am. I would say this though. A huge amount depends on whether Trump is a one-term or two-term president. If he's reelected in America, if you're reelected president, it kind of legitimates what you've been doing, and it sort of codes it, you know, embodies it, or what's the word I'm looking for, it codifies it, you know. It's hard to then say, well, this is just beyond the bounds. I mean, hey, the people reelected you after doing this, right? So I think that's one reason I'm very concerned about the reelection of President Trump. If you think these norms and institutions are important, and some people don't, but if you think they are, if you think Trump has done real damage to them, if you think we've escaped maybe even more damage by the fact that the institutions have some strength, that the norms still have some strength, that the public and various groups, whether it's judges or lawyers or the media, state officials, people running private institutions, the not-for-profit sector, a lot of people have said, wait a second, that's not quite right, you know. But if Trump gets reelected and is governs for four more years, I'm not sure how much people then say that's not right. Do we stop getting shocked at all by fake news, enemies of the people, Trump tweeting this morning that he hopes that AT&T, I guess that some investors take it over or something. I couldn't quite follow it, but I guess there's a possibility of some kind of, you know, to shake up there. And, you know, they shut down CNN, which they own because CNN has been hostile to Trump, allegedly. I mean, are we just going to accept that that's kind of how our president behaves? Really, like, I would say, like a third world sort of elected, sort of dictator, not quite a dictator, but kind of none of the usual bounds in terms of the private sector, civil society, limited government, rule of law, and not just law, but as you said, kind of institutions and norms as well. So I think it makes a big difference whether Trump is a one-term president who's looked back on as kind of an aberration, or whether he does set the new normal.
Well, you have your own organization now called Defending Democracy Together, and that the website for that organization, at least, says, quote, "We are dedicated to defending America's democratic norms, values, and institutions, and fighting for consistent conservative principles like rule of law, free trade, and expanding legal immigration." And many look at what's happening today, and they would say that it appears most conservatives who pin the Republican label on themselves have taken a different path. So how many followers do you have for your organization Defending Democracy Together?
It's a good question. We're not really in the business of, like, you know, doing mass marketing. We've had a couple hundred thousand people sign petitions for Republicans for the Rule of Law about letting the Mueller investigation be completed without interference, which more or less happened, about letting about election security legislation, which has bipartisan support, where for some reason Trump is resisting really common sense efforts to just make sure the states can run elections in which there's no foreign interference. There's some support. I think a lot of people's views are in flux. A lot of people, you know, don't follow everything day to day, minute to minute. And the president says X, and they think, okay, I guess maybe X is right. I think it's important that there be someone else saying, no, X isn't right. What about Y? That's why we have elections. It's why we have debates. Mm-hmm. It's why it's unfortunate that the president's team is trying to shut down these primaries, as they may have succeeded in doing, we'll see, in South Carolina, for example, because they want to limit the amount of debate. And that also is a very bad sign. Who's ever heard of such a thing when there's actually now three candidates? You can say they're not ultimately going to win or whatever, but what they're the former congressmen, former members of Congress, former governors running. And, you know, in the past, I was there in the first Bush White House. Pat Buchanan, who was a lot less qualified than these people, got a lot of votes in New Hampshire and sent a message and so forth. So I really think the Democratic norms, that aspect of things is really important for me.
Well, that brings up something we spoke about last week with a woman by the name of Catherine Gale. I don't know if you know who she is.
Yes, but she's, I do okay. know her, yeah.
Well, she started a group called Democracy Found in her home state. She also, with Michael Porter from the Harvard Business School, has written a report on why they feel our political industry is destroying our democracy. They also have suggestions on how to fix it. But one of the things that she points out is that, you know, of course, political parties are not mentioned in the Constitution, and yet they have an iron grip on how things work. And this is a good example of that. The Republicans, at the behest of Donald Trump, may cancel four primaries, so he cannot be challenged in the primaries, which cheats the voters, doesn't it?
I think it does. And I think there have been constraints on parties doing that in the past. They've canceled them sometimes in a few states when there literally was no opposition. So what's the point of going to the expense? But in this case, there obviously is opposition. I mean, the whole question of the party system, I mean, there's been hyper-partisanship now, which I do think is damaging. On the other hand, there's a lot of political science literature about how, and, you know, common sense, obviously, that parties are useful, important. You got to organize things somehow. You wouldn't want to presumably have 100 people just floating around the Senate with no kind of way of, you know, organizing them. And voters use it as an organizing principle and so forth. It helps to govern. It cuts across the branches in a good way sometimes. But I think you see this in North Carolina, which I haven't followed that closely, but a little bit, the partisanship has really got a little crazy. And even at the state level, where a state like North Carolina, which has a tradition of governors working across the aisle and actually getting a lot done, I think the state is a big success story, really, when you get right down to it, for the last 20, 30, 40 years, right? I mean, now you see the kind of bitter partisanship here at the state level, and obviously in the congressional election where there was actual fraud, I think it's fair to say, right? You know, so I'm sympathetic to Catherine and others who really have come to dislike the party system almost and say, why can't we have third parties or independent candidates? I'm open to that, really. I think it's a good question going forward, you know, whether we should change various rules and laws to make it easier to lessen the stranglehold the two parties have on the system.
Well, one of the people impacted by a decision to cancel primaries, if that decision comes to fruition, it would be Illinois Tea Party Congressman and conservative talk radio host Joe Walsh, who is mounting a campaign against Donald Trump. And you encouraged him to run. Why him?
I encourage Bill Weld and Mark Sanford to run, too. And honestly, okay. I think people should look. I encourage Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, to run. I encourage, you know, a lot of other people, Ben Sass and Mitt Romney. I think we need a choice, as many, and honestly, at this point, more choices the better. We ended up with people who are former officials, not current senators and governors running. Maybe that'll change a little bit over the next 2 months if Trump looks more vulnerable. But I think sending a message that everyone is not just rolling over for Trump on the Republican side is important. He's probably going to be the nominee, obviously, but it makes a difference if there's some opposition to him or not.
I mean, I can see why you would encourage Bill Weld. He's cut from some conservative, traditional conservative cloth, as to a certain degree as Mark Sanford. But Walsh is this Tea Party congressman who said some fairly provocative things on his radio show as a talk show host. We have a president in the White House now who I think views his job as being the star of a reality television show on a daily basis. Do we really need another media figure in the Oval Office?
So, I mean, I think the difference is a couple of things. Walsh has apologized for the really, you know, things he said that were wrong, and they really were wrong, and he's apologized for those and made clear that he learned something from that. He was a Tea Party guy who I think stands by a lot of what the Tea Party was for, limited government, the debt and the deficit, concern about that and so forth. But also says, you know, I was kind of part of a movement that created a climate that made Trump possible. And I regret that. And I give Walsh credit for that. He supported Trump in 2016. I didn't. But, you know, that probably lets Walsh say to some voters, look, I supported him. I wished him well. I thought he could do some good. He could shake things up. But we're paying too high a price. So as a practical matter, I think Walsh can speak to some voters who Weld probably can't speak to. I can't speak to. Sanford can't speak to. It's a free country. I'm not saying Joe Walsh would be my number one choice for president of the United States. I'm saying that giving the voters a choice, letting people who supported Trump in 2016 say, you know what, maybe I made a mistake, or maybe I didn't make a mistake. Maybe one term of Trump's okay, but we don't need a second term. I think Walsh can play a useful role in the primary debates.
I know President Trump did not win the popular vote, but he won enough electoral votes to defeat Hillary Clinton, and there were enough people in that group of people to push him over the top. So in 2016, enough voters rejected traditional liberalism and traditional conservatism and chose Donald Trump. Do you see any evidence that your school of thought or the school of thought espoused by a moderate like Joe Biden or progressives like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren can win back the people who tried Trump on for size?
You know, some. I mean, Trump has not expanded his support. That seems quite certain, and that's unusual. I mean, the economy's been pretty good. We haven't had any wars. You would think a president would now be, you know, stronger than he was when elected. Trump, if anything, seems a little weaker. I mean, he loses these matchups to Biden and even to Sanders and Warren, often by more than he lost the popular vote to Clinton. So I think there's some shying away from Trump. But, you know, with the economy being good and as I say, no obvious foreign policy disasters yet, people and some actual conservative victories, obviously, on the courts and elsewhere, people are sort of somewhat in the mode of, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's OK. We don't like this part of Trump, but the rest of it's decent. I think getting people to, as I would view it, be more alarmed about the erosion of norms and institutions, the nativism, the rhetoric, the demagoguery would be a good. What's one thing I think some of these challengers to Trump can do? You know, I mean, sometimes the threats are not obvious.
He is losing in the polls to a lot of these Democratic candidates. But do you think people are telling the truth to pollsters?
I don't know.
Okay. In this region, as you've already alluded to, we have an election going on in the 9th Congressional District. Tomorrow's Election Day. We have the man who describes himself as the most conservative member of the North Carolina legislature, State Senator Dan Bishop, running for Congress in the 9th Congressional District do-over against Democrat Dan McCready. It's a neck-and-neck race. I don't know how much you know about this race or how closely you've been following it, but Bishop fully supports Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is coming tonight to Fayetteville to campaign for him on Election Eve. This is going to be the focus of the national media tomorrow as the election results come in. So if you're called on to be on a CNN or an MSNBC panel, would you be rooting for McCready or for Bishop?
Leaving aside the analysis, and I think, look, even if it's a close race, that would be a pretty big move in the Democrats' direction compared to obviously 4, 6, or 8 years ago for this district. No, I'd be rooting for McCready, whom I know very slightly. I respect his military service. I think he's a pretty moderate Democrat. Bishop you know, people up down here know much more than I do. They can make up their own minds. But I've just gone to the websites of both, and I got to say, you read about McCready, and he looks like a serious, sober person who could help advance a useful agenda in Washington. And Bishop seems like a guy who's just trying to sound like Donald Trump.
Democrats think that demography is on their side, at least eventually, that America is changing with it. Politics and priorities of younger people and people of color are changing, and they'll be in the majority. If they're right, does that spell doom for Republicans and for conservative thought? I only have about 25 seconds left.
I think they're basically right. Young people really don't like Trump's kind of version of Republicanism, but a lot of damage can be done before things get corrected. And also, you know, people can go overreact the opposite direction. I don't want an America where the choice is Trump or Sanders, and I'm worried that we're going in that direction.
Bill Kristol is the founder of the Weekly Standard. He appears regularly on CNN and MSNBC, and he's the Vann Professor of Ethics and Society at Davidson College. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Good luck with the election and everything else down here.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.